This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Richard Ovenden, author of the book Burning the Books, A History of the Deliberate Destruction of Knowledge. Richard, welcome to the New Books Network.
It's great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Yeah, I'm currently the 25th holder of an ancient title, which is called Bodley's Librarian. And that means I'm the executive director of the research libraries of the University of Oxford. And they're centered around a historic institution called the Bodleian Library. And it's called that because it was founded by a man called Sir Thomas Bodley at the end of the 16th century. But actually, this year, we're celebrating our 700th anniversary as the central library of the university, because in 1320, the first building to house the university's collection of books and documents began to be constructed. So that's what I do in my day job. It's a big library. We have over 14 million printed items, petabytes worth of digital data. We acquire 1,000 new books every day. We have over 2 million research visits to our physical libraries every year. And I have just over 500 full-time equivalent staff members. So we're a busy, very busy research library in one of the most famous and successful universities in the English-speaking world. And I've been in this industry for, you know, 30 years. I read history at university. I was at graduate school. And then I came into the world of libraries. And I've worked in four or five different libraries before ending up in Oxford 17 years ago. And I couldn't be anywhere better than the Bodleian.
Well, you sound extraordinarily busy, and yet somehow in the midst of all that, you found time to write this book. What was it that led you to write a book about the destruction of knowledge?
Well, that's a very good question because, you know, libraries are really all about the preservation of knowledge. Well, that's one of their kind of core roles. And that aspect of the work of libraries and archives as well has been something which I've been concerned as that it's been less highlighted as one of our roles, because partly because I think in the digital world, it's all about access to content. And, you know, libraries have been very focused on that access piece, and rightly so. It's absolutely crucial. But to me, there's no access without preservation. And so I've been wanting to kind of highlight the role of preservation as part of the work of libraries and archives for a while. And then there are a couple of kind of trigger events that made me start writing the book. One of them was a partnership that we have in Oxford with the State Library of Berlin. and the Staatsbibliothek zu Berlin is has one of its branches on Unter den Linden, right in the heart of Berlin. And I was visiting them a few years ago and crossed the street from the library and stumbled upon the location of the famous book burning that took place there, orchestrated by Joseph Goebbels under the Nazi regime on the 10th of May, 1933. And I thought, God, you know, my mother was still alive, was alive when this happened. She'd just been born and she's still alive today. It's not that long ago that, you know, these terrible things could happen. And then a few months later, I read an article in a British newspaper about the UK government's immigration policy, which was become very, very severe back in the spring of 2018. And it focused on what was what's called the hostile environment. So they pursued people, many of them who'd been resident in the UK for many, many years, and forced them to prove their right to remain in the UK. You know, when did they arrive? What was the documentation? Show us the evidence. And at the same time as they were pursuing all of these individuals, our fellow citizens, and putting them under extraordinary pressure, they actually had all of the evidence that many of them needed in their own possession, in the Home Office, the government department that was pursuing this policy. And they destroyed it. In 2010, they destroyed all of the landing records from the 1950s and 60s when the UK government invited people from the former Commonwealth and Empire, from the West Indies, from South Asia, to come and work and live in the UK. And I thought that this was a perfect example of how the preservation of knowledge is absolutely fundamental for the health of society, for the rights of citizens, for a democratic and open society. And so I wrote an op-ed in the Financial Times, a newspaper, and the next day a publisher contacted me and said, this would make a very interesting book. And, you know, 2 years later, it's published and here we are.
That's one of the things that I think comes across very clearly in your book, which is that we think we might sometimes have this misconception about libraries as these dusty places where you know people are just you know checking out you know novels, what have you. But as you explain early in the book, they're really about knowledge, and as the saying goes, knowledge is power. And I thought that it came across very clearly when you were describing the destruction of the ancient libraries in your early chapter, where you're talking about how these were places where you would have conquerors that would destroy them and or loot them, precisely because they recognized possessing that knowledge gave them an advantage over their counterparts, over their foes in their times.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was one of the big surprises for me as I was kind of researching the kind of ancient libraries and archives, which I hadn't really studied before in any great depth. And, you know, there's been extraordinary discoveries by archaeologists over the last 150 years, beginning in the middle of the 19th century and going up to the present day. And these discoveries have made us change the way we think about the ancient world, because they found such rich library and archive collections in the form of cuneiform tablets in clay. And they show that the earliest settled civilizations that we have any documentary evidence for, from ancient Mesopotamia in particular, that they were, you know, basically they were taxing their citizens. So the rulers were imposing tax regimes, that they had quite well organized commerce with bureaucracy that went around that for things like customs, imports and exports. And that many of these ancient collections were about predicting the future. So partly they were about documenting what was going on today, in particular with commerce, so that they could be taxed. Then the other half of the story is about predicting the future. So astronomy, astrology, divination, and other kind of religious texts, which are about how you could make better decisions about your future life. And one of the things that came across very powerfully to me in looking at things like the library of King Ashurbanipal, you know, this great ruler of Assyria in the 7th century before the Christian era, whose library is really the first library that we know of to try and encompass the whole of kind of recorded knowledge as it was known at the time. And what we know from his library is that he was deliberately targeting library and archival collections in his enemy's territory to get his agents to either by forcibly remove those tablets, what we would today perhaps call books, those texts about predicting the future. And that would make his enemies less good at predicting the future and make him stronger, better at predicting the future. And I thought this is a kind of, you know, very good example of how knowledge is power, how, you know, as Derrida says, there's no political power without power over the archive.
Now, you proceed through your book chronologically, but these themes reoccur. And I was thinking about, as you were describing this, how what you're describing also fits what was the intention of the British when they burned the Library of Congress in 1814, the sense during the War of 1812, the sense that they that by destroying the collection of available knowledge, the knowledge available to the leaders of the new republic, that they would be able to set them back and inhibit their ability to effectively govern and thus impede British rule.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's about weakening the branch of government that depends on knowledge. How do you, you know, the United States for Britain was a rogue state, you know, and it's very interesting as I was reading it, you know, and I've been to the Library of Congress many times and used it as a researcher as well as a colleague. And it's such a fabulous institution. And of course, this story is so important to the history of the Library of Congress. And, you know, it's also a trope in American history, particularly in the latter part of the 19th century. And yet it was never taught to me as a schoolboy studying, you know, the 19th century British history. You know, it's a really dark episode, I think, in my own country's, you know, past, is that, you know, we deliberately targeted the center of government and the library, which the legislature and the executive branch depended on in this new nation to govern, and many of the books, ironically, were British publications. You know, Statutes of the Realm, the, you know, State Trials, and all of these things which helped, you know, the legislators and government officials, you know, determine how they were going to take the Constitution and all those arrangements forward. And you know, we have an eyewitness account of this. A British serviceman who was part of Admiral Cockburn's army, and he was, you know, ironically, he was actually an alumnus of the college in Oxford where I'm a fellow now. He's called George Gleig. He was a Scotsman, and even he said that, you know, it would have been better if we'd spared the library. And, you know, that was, you know, quite striking that someone writing in, I think he published his book in 1818, would admit to this, that it was, you know, it's not a good look, really. And I think, you know, there's this kind of narrative also of renewal after great acts of destruction that prompts renewal in realizing that knowledge is so important that it must be recovered or protected or replaced. And that's what happened in the Library of Congress's case. Thomas Jefferson offered his own private library, easily the best private library on the North American continent at the time. And he offered it as a replacement. He didn't give it to Congress. He asked for it to be purchased, but made favorable rates. And you know, Congress debated this for actually for quite a number of months, whether they should vote the money, because it was quite a lot of money. And there were, you know, there were many needs to kind of, you know, recover the country after the war. But they did so. And the library became renewed, and it had even better collections. It was bigger. It was more modern. It had more diverse material from the kind of other European countries and from, you know, really cutting edge European thinkers. So it was a great, in a way, it helped rebuild the Library of Congress into the great institution that it subsequently became and, of course, still is.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That issue of destruction and renewal also comes across with what is, you know, probably the most famous library in at least Western history, and that is the Library of Alexandria. It was a library that I you know, was aware of, and many people oftentimes hear, you know, mentions of it in various places. What I wasn't aware of, though, was that it's not really one library that we're talking about when we talk about the library. It's actually ones that have been continually destroyed and then reconstructed over a span of centuries, and how it really, you know, speaks to that theme about how so much about knowledge isn't just about preservation, it's about that process of recovery and reconstitution.
Yeah, I think the Alexandria case is a really good one, because it's also a series of myths, and the myths have kind of recur every time there's a in you know, the last couple of hundred years that there's been the destruction of a library. Alexandria becomes mentioned. You know, this is the new Alexandria. This is the Alexandria of our age. And I don't know. I grew up watching Carl Sagan's program Civilization. I don't know if you ever saw it, but the first episode of that, Carl Sagan sort of conjures up the vision of this ancient library, you know, the greatest library of the first great world civilization, you know, in the Greek speaking world. And, you know, he says if there was anywhere in the past that he could go back to, it would be to the Library of Alexandria. All that lost knowledge of philosophers and playwrights and poets, he would be able to have access to. But of course, what didn't happen is what Carl Sagan suggested in Civilization, is that there was a catastrophic event which the whole lot went up in flames. And actually what happened, there probably were fires. You know, some of the collections were lost. I think the great conflagration, which is cited by ancient writers, which was caused by the civil war between Caesar and Ptolemy, actually happened in the dockyards, where there were places of deposit for books. There was a decree that any book coming into the harbour of Alexandria on a ship should be given over to the library so that it could be copied. And I think there was a warehouse on the docks that got caught up in their battles, and those books were lost. Whereas the two main sites of the Library of Alexandria, the Museion and the Serapion, they suffered at other times and were protected. And actually what happened with the decline of the library is that it's a slow process of neglect, because all that we really know about it is that, and what the ancient writers all agree on, is that there was at one point a great library that drew scholars from all over the world, and that by the 5th century, the 4th or 5th century, it wasn't there anymore. So I think that that process of neglect is, for me, the great cautionary tale for our own age. And actually, I was reading the autobiography of our founder, Sir Thomas Bodley. It was published in the early 17th century. And that actually cites what they call the Great Egyptian Library as, again, as a kind of warning sign, because Sir Thomas Bodley was renewing a library that was destroyed in the previous kind of century, in the 16th century. And they cite Alexandria again, even then, even 400 years ago, it's a watchword for civilization at threat. And, you know, I think to me that's something that we in our own age must take very great consideration of, because libraries and archives all over the world are being underfunded. They're not being properly supported by their communities, by their governing regimes, and society has so much to lose if we lose a library.
I was thinking about how in so many ways that's a more powerful tragedy, because it's something that, because it happens in slow motion, it's unspectacular, it's undramatic, people aren't aware of it. I'd like to, going back to the what happened with like the Library of Congress, where you have a destruction that provides a degree of galvanization, that there's a perceived need that because this was a conscious act and also a concentrated act, that there's this idea that it must be rectified, whereas that slow process of constriction, shall we say, is something, because it happens slowly and over and oftentimes invisibly people who aren't directly involved in libraries, they just don't see how it's something that happens. By the time they're aware of it, it's already done. And because it's happened over such a long period of time, it seems unrecoverable.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's something about kind of society's complacency. And of course, the great writer, Edward Gibbon, whose Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire was, one of the great texts of the Enlightenment. He cites Alexandria as part of that process of decline, and he doesn't attribute it to a single catastrophic act, but to that sort of slow, that slow motion, decline and neglect. And I think that he attributes part of the collapse of the Roman Empire to what happened to Alexandria. And I think we need to be aware of these things today. I think they're good lessons for us to really kind of take stock of, in an age where so much of knowledge has been transferred to the digital realm. And of course, that creates huge opportunities for sharing knowledge and for making it more accessible. But the way that it's happened, very slowly, without us really terribly closely, is that we've transferred the control of knowledge to a few small, very, very powerful tech companies. What my colleague in Oxford, Timothy Garton Ash, calls the private superpowers. And the private superpowers have control over so much of the domain of knowledge, and we've let it happen and have unwittingly contributed to it by giving our own, if you like, online labor every time we put a search term into Google, every time we click like on a social media post. We are strengthening the knowledge power, the power over knowledge that the big tech companies have. And even today, this morning on BBC Radio, I heard that the UK government had established an embassy to the big tech companies in Silicon Valley. They'd appointed someone to be a kind of quasi-ambassador. And if that isn't a sign of the shift of power, I don't know what is.
You talk a lot about the destruction of knowledge by rulers and also by accident, but you also talk about the destruction of knowledge by individuals. And you have two particular cases that serve as contrapoints. One is the burning of personal papers by Thomas Crummell in the 16th century. And then you have the non-destruction, shall we say, of Franz Kafka's writings and papers. And I find that they point to some of the smaller ways in which knowledge is lost, or in the case of Kafka, preserved as a legacy. That especially was taken by your point that, but for that decision to preserve Kafka's papers, we wouldn't have Kafka today. Words in our very language, like Kafkaesque, wouldn't exist but for that decision.
I think this is, again, a really kind of fascinating area. I mean, how many of us kind of inherit perhaps a property from a loved one, our parents, or a family member, and we go through their property and we find boxes of documents or letters or family photographs, and we decide what shall we do with these. You know, they sometimes we think, you know, well, we really ought to keep them. Should we, how do we best keep them? And sometimes we think, well, oh dear, that's not a very kind of comfortable thing to keep. But let's just, you know, consign this to the flames, so that you know, other loved ones don't have to read some, you know, uncomfortable fact from the past. And I think that was definitely in the mind of some of the individual cases I talk about. You know, Franz Kafka definitely left, you know, explicit instructions to his great friend Max Brod, his literary executor, that, you know, his unpublished work is not fit to see the light of day and should be destroyed at his death. And Kafka disobeyed those Brod disobeyed those instructions from Kafka. And, you know, we're very glad that he did, because so much of his published, what we now think of his published work, his great writings, hadn't appeared in his lifetime. But I think that sort of sign that knowledge can affect the future by leaving a trail from the past, and that's all about the reputation of individuals. And I think the case of Thomas Cranmer is a slightly different one, because it's about protecting, it's about his household destroying his correspondence. So when at the point that Cromwell is arrested by Henry VIII, they don't want to have any evidence that could be incriminating for their, you know, for their boss. And so they destroyed the outgoing correspondence. And so, you know, we have some of, they destroy the incoming correspondence. And all that we have is the outgoing correspondence from Thomas Cromwell's desk to other individuals, that has, some of which has survived by chance. And so, you know, we've lost all of that history, that riches. And, you know, people like Dermot McCulloch and Hilary Mantel have tried to kind of reconstruct it and done, you know, superb jobs at doing that. But the motivation at the time was to stop evidence from falling into the hands of Thomas's accusers. Now, one of the other incidents I talk about in the domain of private knowledge is the writer Lord Byron, of course, famously, you know, Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know, who wrote, you know, for what was at the time extremely sort of avant-garde and gripping poetry, but who had a lifestyle that was notorious in British society and, in fact, across Europe. And his memoirs were, again, before his death, entrusted to a friend who he was told could see it into publication, that would make his friend rich because it would be an instant bestseller. But his friend and other family members were so horrified at what they read inside the memoirs. And of course, he was, you know, there were all sorts of rumors about him having an incestuous relationship with his sister and various other, you know, kind of sexual misdemeanors, or what were called sexual misdemeanors at the time. They decided, there was a kind of family conference or conference between friends and family members, and it was burnt in the grate of his publisher, John Murray, in a room that still exists. The grate's still there in 50 Albemarle Street in central London. And that sense that the future needs preserving from the past, this you know, counterpoint to preservation, is the deliberate destruction of things which could harm an individual's reputation or a family's reputation. And so there are always, you know, in everybody's lives, there are these moments where those decisions have to be taken. And in the case of, you know, great writers or politicians or figures of state, they become, you know, decisions which are, you know, affect the whole of society in some ways, the whole of culture or future history.
It also can have a very contemporary relevance. And I was thinking about the examples you cite of the British possession of colonial archives, the possession of the Iraqi archives, the archives that you in South Africa from the 1980s. How these are ones in which the handling of which with which have a lot of secrets, which the possessors are oftentimes very unwilling to share, becomes a subject of great controversy, not just between governments necessarily, but even in terms of societies and communities within them.
I think this is, again, really about the control of history and the kind of the sense that, you know, the control of knowledge is a way to shape how the future will look at the past. And that control is increasingly contested. You know, the history is more contested today than I think it has been for a very long time. And I think that kind of control over kind of key issues for society, racial relations, you know, decolonization, the collapse of empires, the rights of new citizens in new countries to have control over their own past. These are issues which are incredibly current today and ones in which knowledge plays an absolutely crucial power. And all of those incidents of the former European colonial powers and the way that they pulled out of the states that were part of their empires, knowledge has an absolutely critical part to play at that moment of decolonization and of independence, because so many of those colonial archives were destroyed deliberately. Sometimes it was just part of kind of, you know, what administrators thought was good record keeping practices. In many cases, it was about colonial administrators hiding their misdemeanors and trying to protect themselves from new rulers who would not look kindly on what had happened. And we see that happening today. You know, in Guatemala, their recent civil war revealed an important archive of the state secret police, which had been used for a period of time to resolve many very kind of bitter disputes in legal cases, and has now been closed again. And this has become, you know, a highly kind of contentious issue in terms of civil rights in Central America. We have seen it with the Iraqi archives that I talk about at length in my book, where the coalition forces seized many archives in Iraq after the invasion in 2003, took them back to the United States, digitized them so that they could be text mined for evidence of weapons of mass destruction, and then kept in the United States. And I think, you know, there are complex arguments over why they weren't returned at the time. The last of the great collections, the archive of the Ba'ath Party, which was, you know, essentially the party which had control over Iraq, led by under Saddam Hussein's rule for, you know, 50 years, that archive has only just in the last few months gone back to Iraq. And only now, I think, by having control over that archive again, can Iraq come to terms with what has been a very, very difficult past, you know, absolutely catastrophic in terms of the loss of life and the, you know, the collapse of civil society there. And so I think archives and libraries are absolutely crucial for, you know, enabling that kind of social healing to come to pass. And I contrast things like the Iraq case with what had happened in the former East Germany, where the Stasi archives became part of a process of social healing, where individuals had the right to access their own file in the Stasi archives so that they could see who was informing on them, you know, family members, neighbors, friends. And, you know, millions of people took up that right in the years following 1989. And, you know, it was extremely well handled, I think, by the Federal Republic. The person who was in charge of that process later became the president of the unified Germany, Joachim Gauck. And again, in South Africa, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission used archives as well as oral testimony to try and come to terms with their own difficult past, although the previous regime destroyed lots and lots of archives, which is the commission cited as one of the barriers to their progress. And so I think we need to bear this in mind, again, as societies which have gone through, you know, civil upheaval and social unrest, that, you know, archives can be part of a new and better future.
It's that disconnect that I find that comes across your book that I find so fascinating. As you point out, we're history, the past is more contested than ever. We're more aware of the power of knowledge than ever before. And yet you feel it necessary to end your book with a coda, having to, again, make the case for library and archives, when you would think that given that awareness, that case has already been proven. If we're aware of this knowledge, yet you would think that we would be aware of the value of archives. And yet there's also, when I finished the book, it was pretty clear why you needed to make that case as well.
Well, thank you, because I feel it, you know, every day in my job. You know, I feel the need to actually make that case, because there's, you know, on the one hand, there's a kind of, you know, parts of society that are relatively affluent and, you know, have, you know, excellent access to technology. There's a kind of complacent sense, even among members of the University of Oxford, that, oh, everything's online and, you know, we don't need libraries anymore. And yet, on the other hand, we have, you know, sort of, you know, that hidden role, the work that libraries and archives do, and we're tend not to be very good at sort of blowing our own trumpet and making our own case in a very kind of public way in parts of, you know, public discourse. And we need to get much better at arguing that case, because, you know, the preservation of knowledge is a pillar of an open society, alongside, you know, freedom of the press, you know, free elections, independent judiciaries, you know, all of those things. An open, plural society depends on them, and the preservation of knowledge is one of those. And it's not just about educating our citizens, but in a democracy, we need to have citizens who are educated or have access to and regularly, have access to information. But, you know, the rights of citizens are dependent upon, you know, access to laws or access to, you know, documents which prove that you're a citizen, you know, or prove that you have the right to own property, or any of these kind of fundamental things that we only realize how important they are when we lose them. And sometimes in my own kind of debates with, you know, people, I sometimes liken libraries and archives to, you know, plumbing. You know, it's when it works well, nobody notices that it's there. And it's only when it stops working that you realize how much you depend on it, and what a terrible thing it is when you lose running water, or you can't flush your lavatory or take a shower or any of those kind of things that we do every day and we don't even think about it. That's what libraries and archives are. They underpin so much of a successful society. They root communities with their identity. They give citizens, from whatever their background, however much money they have, however accomplished they are at doing research, they provide opportunities to get access to and understand the world through knowledge. And they also give an opportunity for, you know, betterment, for improving yourself. And, you know, libraries are societies like the UK and in America and other parts of Europe, we're lucky because you know most of us have the right to walk into a library free of charge and access the information there, access the internet, access books or documents from the past, and we don't know how lucky we are, and we must preserve that at at the for the sake of society and for the sake of the future.
We've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
In my professional life, I'm working on, we're in the middle of a global pandemic, so we're trying to keep our community with access to knowledge. We're trying to make sure our collections are safe, but also so that, you know, the students and researchers of the university, many of them, of course, working on the COVID vaccine or on therapeutic issues to do with COVID. We're trying to make sure they have access for information, and, you know, our open access repository will soon, you know, is publishing Oxford research on COVID all the time, and again, that's made freely available. And in my private life, I'm just writing a piece for a UK blog on what President Trump's presidential library might be like and what the issues would be around that.
It sounds like fantastic work, and I thank you for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
I've enjoyed talking with you, and I hope your readers enjoy accessing my book now that it's available in the U.S. and Canada.
I hope they will, too.